Because of their love, despite the haste and their fear of the advent of new foes, Tuor let raise a great stone cairn over Glorfindel, just there beyond the perilous way by the precipice of Eagle Stream, and Thorondor has let not yet any harm come thereto. But yellow flowers have fared thither, and blow ever now about that mound in those unkindly places. But the folk of the Golden Flower wept at its building, and might not dry their tears. Now who shall tell of the wanderings of Tuor and the exiles of Gondolin in the wastes that lie beyond the mountains to the south of the Vale of Tumladen? Miseries were theirs, and death, colds and hungers, and ceaseless watches. That they won ever through those regions infested by Melko's evil came from the great slaughter and damage done to his power in that assault, and from the speed and wariness with which Tuor led them, for of a certain Melko knew of that escape and was furious thereat. Ulmo had heard tidings in the far oceans of the deeds that were done, but he could not yet aid them, for they were far from waters and rivers, and indeed they thirsted sorely, and they knew not the way. But after a year and more of wandering, in which many a time they journeyed long tangled in the magic of those wastes, only to come again upon their own tracks. Once more the summer came, and nigh to its height they came at last upon a stream, and following this came to better lands, and were a little comforted. Here did Voronwë guide them, for he had caught a whisper of Ulmo's in that stream one late summer's night, and he got ever much wisdom from the sound of waters. Now he led them even till they came down to Sirion, which that stream fed, and then both Tuor and Voronwë saw that they were not far from the outer issue of old of the way of escape, and were once more in that deep dale of alders. Here were all the bushes trampled and the trees burnt, and the dale wall scarred with flame, and they wept, for they thought they knew the fate of those who sundered aforetime from them at the tunnel mouth. Now they journeyed down that river, but were again in fear from Melko, and fought affrays with his orc bands, and were in peril from the wolf riders. But his fire drakes sought not at them, both for the great exhaustion of their fires in the taking of Gondolin, and the increasing power of Ulmo as the river grew. So came they after many days, for they went slowly and got their sustenance very hardly, to those great heaths and morasses above the land of willows, and Voronwë knew not those regions. Now here goes Sirion a very great way under earth, diving at the great cavern of the tumultuous winds, but running clear again above the pools of twilight, even where Tulkas after fought with Melko's self. Tuor had fared over these regions by night and dusk after Ulmo came to him amid the reeds, and he remembered not the ways. In places that land is full of deceits and very marshy, and here the host had long delay and was vexed by sore flies, for it was autumn still, and agues and fevers fared amongst them, and they cursed Melko. Yet came they at last to the great pools and the edges of that most tender land of willows, and the very breath of the winds thereof brought rest and peace to them. And for the comfort of that place, the grief was assuaged of those who mourned the dead in that great fall. There women and maids grew fair again, and their sick were healed, and old wounds ceased to pain. Yet they alone who of reason feared their folk living still in bitter thraldom in the hells of iron sang not, nor did they smile. Here they abode very long indeed, and Earendel was a grown boy, ere the voice of Ulmo's conches drew the heart of Tuor, that his sea-longing returned with a thirst the deeper for years of stifling. And all that host arose at his bidding, and got them down Sirion to the sea. Now the folk that had passed into the Eagle's Cleft, and who saw the fall of Glorfindel, had been nigh 800s. A large wayfaring, yet was it a sad remnant of so fair and numerous a city. But But they who arose from the grasses of the land of willows in years after and fared away to sea, when spring set Celandine in the meads, and they had held sad festival in memorial of Glorfindel, these numbered but 300s and a score of men and man-children, and 260 of women and maid-children. Now the number of women was few because of their hiding or being stowed by their kinsfolk in secret places in the city. There were they burned or slain, or taken and enthralled, and the rescue parties found them too seldom, and it is the greatest ruth to think of this. For the maids and women of the Gondothlim were as fair as the sun, and as lovely as the moon, and brighter than the stars. Glory dwelt in that city of Gondolin of the Seven Names, and its ruin was the most dread of all the sacks of cities upon the face of the earth. Nor Babylon, nor Nineveh, nor the towers of Truy, nor all the many takings of Rum that is greatest among men, saw such terror as fell that day upon Amon-Gwareth in the kindred of the gnomes. And this is esteemed the worst work that Melko has yet thought of in the world. Yet now those exiles of Gondolin dwelt at the mouth of Sirion by the waves of the great sea. There they take the name of Lothlim, the people of the flower, for Gondothlim is a name too sore to their hearts. And fair among the Lothlim Eärendil grows in the house of his father, and the great tale of Tuor is come to its waning. Then said Little Heart, son of Bronwyg, alas for Gondolin.
The earliest text. Important elements in the early evolution of the history of the Elder Days are my father's hurried notes. As I have described them elsewhere, these notes were for the most part pencilled at furious speed, the writing now rubbed and faint and in places after long study scarcely decipherable. On slips of paper, disordered and dateless, or in a little notebook. In these, during the years in which he was composing the Lost Tales, he jotted down thoughts and suggestions, many of them being no more than simple sentences or mere isolated names, serving as reminders of work to be done, stories to be told, or changes to be made. Among these notes is found what must be the earliest trace of the story of the fall of Gondolin.
Isfin, daughter of Fingolma, loved from afar by Eol, Arval, of the Molkin of the Gnomes. He is strong and in favour with Fingolma and with the sons of Feanor, to whom he is akin, because he is a leader of the miners and searches after hidden jewels. But he is ill-favoured, and Isfin loathes him.
For an explanation of the choice of the word gnomes, see the prologue. Fingolma was an early name of the later Finwë, the leader of the second host of the elves, the Noldor, on the great journey from Palisor, the land of their awakening. Isfin appears in the tale of the fall of Gondolin as the sister of Turgon, king of Gondolin, and the mother of Meglin, son of Eol. It is obvious that this note is a form of the story told in the Lost Tales, despite the major difference. In the note, it is Eol, the miner of the Molkin, who is the suitor for the daughter of Fingolma, Isfin, who rejects him on account of his ugliness. In the Lost Tale, on the other hand, the rejected and ugly suitor is Meglin, the son of Eol, and his mother is Isfin, the sister of Turgon, king of Gondolin. And it is said expressly that the tale of Isfin and Eol may not here be told, presumably because my father thought that it would go too far afield. I think it most probable that the brief note given above was written before the tale of the fall of Gondolin and before the advent of Maeglin, and that the story in its origin had no association with Gondolin. Henceforward, I shall usually refer to the Lost Tale of the Fall of Gondolin simply as the tale. Turlin and the Exiles of Gondolin. There is a loose page, carrying a short prose piece, unquestionably preserved in its entirety, that bears the title Turlin and the Exiles of Gondolin. It can be placed chronologically after the tale of the fall of Gondolin, and was clearly the abandoned start of a new version of the tale. My father hesitated much over the name of the hero of Gondolin, and in this text he gave him the name Turlin, but altered it throughout to Turgon. Since this, not rare, interchange of names between characters can be needlessly confusing, I will name him Tuor in my text of the piece that follows. The anger of the gods, the Valar, against the gnomes, and the sealing of Valinor against all comers, with which this piece begins, arose from their rebellion and their evil deeds at the Haven of the Swans. This is known as the kinslaying, and is of importance in the story of the fall of Gondolin, and indeed of the later history of the Elder Days.
Turlin, Tuor, and the Exiles of Gondolin. Then said Ilfiniol, son of Bronwegg, "Know that Ulmo, lord of waters, forgot never the sorrows of the elven kindreds beneath the power of Melko. But he might do little because of the anger of the other gods, who shut their hearts against the race of the gnomes, and dwelt behind the veiled hills of Valinor, heedless of the outer world, so deep was their ruth and regret for the death of the two trees. Nor did any save Ulmo only dread the power of Melko that wrought ruin and sorrow over all the earth. But Ulmo desired that Valinor should gather all its might to quench his evil ere it be too late. And it seemed to him that both purposes might perchance be achieved, if messengers from the gnomes should win to Valinor and plead for pardon and for pity upon the earth. For the love of Palurian and Orome her son for those wide realms did but slumber still. Yet hard and evil was the road from the outer earth to Valinor, and the gods themselves had meshed the ways with magic and veiled the encircling hills. Thus did Ulmo seek unceasingly to stir the gnomes to send messengers unto Valinor. But Melko was cunning and very deep in wisdom, and unsleeping was his wariness in all things that touched the elven kindreds. And their messengers overcame not the perils and temptations of that longest and most evil of all roads, and many that dared to set forth were lost forever. Now tells the tale of how Ulmo despaired that any of the elven race should surpass the dangers of the way, and of the deepest and the latest design that he then fashioned, and of those things which came of it. In those days the greater part of the kindreds of men dwelt after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears in that land of the north that has many names, but which the elves of Kor have named Hissilome, which is the twilit mist, and the gnomes, who of the elfkin know it best, Dorlomin, the land of shadows. A people mighty in numbers were there, dwelling about the wide pale waters of Mithrim, the great lake that lies in those regions, and other folk named them Tunglin, or folk of the harp, for their joy was in the wild music and minstrelsy of the fells and woodlands, but they knew not and sang not of the sea. Now this folk came into those places after the dread battle, being too late summoned thither from afar, and they bore no stain of treachery against the elven kin, but indeed many among them clung to such friendship with the hidden gnomes of the mountains and dark elves, as might be still for the sorrow and mistrust born of those ruinous deeds in the Vale of Niniach, the site of the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Tuor was a man of that folk, son of Peleg, son of Indor, son of Fengel, who was their chief, and hearing the summons had marched out of the deeps of the east with all his folk. But Tuor dwelt not much with his kindred, and loved rather solitude and the friendship of the elves whose tongues he knew. And he wandered alone about the long shores of Mithrim, now hunting in its woods, now making sudden music in the rocks upon his rugged harp of wood strung with the sinews of bears. But he sang not for the ears of men, and many, hearing the power of his rough songs, came from afar to hearken to his harping. But Tuor left his singing and departed to lonely places in the mountains. Many strange things he learned there, broken tidings of far-off things, and longing came upon him for deeper lore. But as yet his heart turned not from the long shores and the pale waters of Mithrim in the mists. Yet was he not fated to dwell forever in those places? For it is said that magic and destiny led him on a day to a cavernous opening in the rocks, down which a hidden river flowed from Mithrim. And Tuor entered that cavern seeking to learn its secret. But having entered, the waters of Mithrim drove him forward into the heart of the rock, and he might not win back into the light. This, men have said, was not without the will of Ulmo, at whose prompting, maybe, the gnomes had fashioned that deep and hidden way. Then came the gnomes to Tuor, and guided him along the dark passages amid the mountains, until he came out once more into the light.
It will be seen that my father had the text of the tale in front of him when he wrote this text, which I will call the Turlin version. For phrases of the one reappear in the other, such as, magic and destiny led him on a day to a cavernous opening. But in several features there are advances on the earlier text. The original genealogy of Tuor remains son of Peleg, son of Indor, but more is told of his people. They were men from the east who came to the aid of the elves in the vast and ruinous battle against the forces of Melko that came to be known as the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. But they came too late, and they settled in great numbers in Hissilome, Twilight Mist, Hithlum, called also Dor Lomin, Land of Shadows. An important and decisive element in the early conception of the history of the Elder Days was the overwhelming nature of the victory of Melko in that battle, so sweeping that a great part of the people named Noldali became his imprisoned slaves. It is said in the tale,
"Know then that the Gondothlim,
the people of Gondolin,
were that kin of the Noldali who alone escaped Melko's power when at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears he slew and enslaved their folk, and wove spells about them, and caused them to dwell in the hells of iron, faring thence at his will and bidding only."
Notable also is the account in this text of Ulmo's design and desire, as his purpose is described in the tale. But in the tale it is said that thereof Tuor understood little, and we are told no more. In this further brief text, the Turlin version, on the other hand, Ulmo spoke of his inability to prevail against the other Valar, isolated in his fear of the power of Melko, and of his wish that Valinor should rise against that power. His attempts also to persuade the Noldali to send messengers to Valinor to plead for compassion and help, while the Valar dwelt behind the veiled hills of Valinor, heedless of the outer world. This was the time known as the Hiding of Valinor, when, as is said in the Turlin version, the gods themselves had meshed the ways to Valinor with magic and veiled the encircling hills. On this crucial element in the history, see the evolution of the story. Most significant is this passage.
Now tells the tale how Ulmo despaired that any of the elven race should surpass the dangers of the way, and of the deepest and the latest design that he then fashioned, and of those things which came of it.
The story told in the sketch of the mythology. I give now the form of the story of the fall of Gondolin that my father wrote in 1926 in a work called Sketch of the Mythology, identifying it later as the original Silmarillion. A portion of the work was included, and its nature explained, in Beren and Luthien, and I have used a further portion to serve as a prologue to this book. My father made later a number of corrections, almost all in the form of additions, and I include most of these in square brackets. Ilmir is the gnomish form for Ulmo.
The great river Sirion flowed through the land southwest. At its mouth was a great delta, and its lower course ran through wide green and fertile lands, little people save by birds and beasts because of the orc raids. But they were not inhabited by orcs, who preferred the northern woods, and feared the power of Ilmir, for Sirion's mouth was in the western seas. Turgon Fingolfin's son had a sister, Isfin. She was lost in Tower na Fuin after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. There she was trapped by the dark elf Eol. Their son was Meglin. The people of Turgon escaping, aided by the prowess of Húrin, were lost from the knowledge of Morgoth, and indeed of all in the world save Ilmir. In a secret place in the hills, their scouts climbing to the tops had discovered a broad valley entirely encircled by the hills, in rings ever lower as they came towards the centre. Amid this ring was a wide land without hills, except for one rocky hill that stuck up from the plain, not right at the centre, but nearest to that part of the outer wall which marched close to the edge of Sirion. The hill nearest to Angband was guarded by Fingolfin's cairn. Ilmir's messages come up Sirion, bidding them take refuge in this valley, and teaching them spells of enchantment to place upon all the hills about to keep off foes and spies. He foretells that their fortress shall stand longest of all the refuges of the elves against Morgoth, and like Doriath, never be overthrown, save by treachery from within. The spells are strongest near to Sirion, although here the encircling mountains are lowest. Here the gnomes dig a mighty winding tunnel under the roots of the mountains that issues at last in the guarded plain. Its outer entrance is guarded by the spells of Ilmir. Its inner is watched unceasingly by the gnomes. It is set there in case those within ever need to escape, and as a way of more rapid exit from the valley for scouts, wanderers, and messages, and also as an entrance for fugitives escaping from Morgoth. Thorondor, king of eagles, removes his eyries to the northern heights of the encircling mountains and guards them against orc spies, sitting upon Fingolfin's cairn. On the rocky hill Amon Gwareth, the hill of watching, whose sides they polish to the smoothness of glass and whose top they level, the great city of Gondolin with gates of steel is built. The plain all about is levelled as flat and smooth as a lawn of clipped grass to the feet of the hills, so that nothing can creep over it unawares. The people of Gondolin grows mighty, and their armouries are filled with weapons. But Turgon does not march to the aid of Nargothrond or Doriath, and after the slaying of Dior, he has no more to do with the sons of Feanor. Finally, he closes the veil to all fugitives, and forbids the folk of Gondolin to leave the valley. Gondolin is the only stronghold of the elves left. Morgoth has not forgotten Turgon, but his search is in vain. Nargothrond is destroyed, Doriath desolate, Húrin's children dead, and only scattered and fugitive elves, gnomes, and Ilkorins left, except such as work in the smithies and mines in great numbers. His triumph is nearly complete. Meglin, son of Eol and Isfin, sister of Turgon, was sent by his mother to Gondolin, and there received, although half of Ilkarin blood, and treated as a prince, last of the fugitives from without. Húrin of Hithlum had a brother, Huor. The son of Huor was Tuor, younger than,
later changed to cousin of,
Túrin, son of Húrin. Rian, Huor's wife, sought her husband's body among the slain on the field of Unnumbered Tears, and died there. Her son, remaining in Hithlum, fell into the hands of the faithless men whom Morgoth drove into Hithlum after that battle, and he was made a thrall. Growing wild and rough, he fled into the woods and became an outlaw and a solitary, living alone and communing with none save rarely with wandering and hidden elves. On a time, Ilmir contrived that he should be led to a subterranean river course, leading out of Mithrim into a chasmed river that flowed at last into the western sea. In this way, his going was unmarked by man, orc, or spy, and unknown of Morgoth. After long wanderings down the western shores, he came to the mouths of Sirion, and there fell in with the gnome Bronwegg, who had once been in Gondolin. They journey secretly up Sirion together. Tuor lingers long in the sweet land Nantathrin, Valley of Willows. But there Ilmir himself comes up the river to visit him, and tells him of his mission. He is to bid Turgon to prepare for battle with Morgoth. For Ilmir will turn the hearts of the Valar to forgive the gnomes and send them succour. If Turgon will do this, the battle will be terrible, but the race of orcs will perish, and will not in after ages trouble elves and men. If not, the people of Gondolin are to prepare for flight to Sirion's mouth, where Ilmir will aid them to build a fleet and guide them back to Valinor. If Turgon does Ilmir's will, Tuor is to abide a while in Gondolin, and then go back to Hithlum with a force of gnomes, and draw men once more into alliance with the elves. For without men, the elves shall not prevail against the orcs and Balrogs. This Ilmir does because he knows that ere 7 full years are past, the doom of Gondolin will come through Meglin, if they sit still in their halls. Tuor and Bronwegg reach the secret way, which they find by grace of Ilmir, and come out upon the guarded plain. Taken captive by the watch, they are led before Turgon. Turgon is grown old and very mighty and proud, and Gondolin so fair and beautiful, and its people so proud of it and confident in its secret and impregnable strength, that the king and most of the people do not wish to trouble about the gnomes and elves without, or care for men, nor do they long any more for Valinor. Meglin approving, the king rejects Tuor's message in spite of the words of Idril the Far-Sighted, also called Idril Silverfoot because she loved to walk barefoot, his daughter, and the wiser of his counsellors. Tuor lives on in Gondolin and becomes a great chieftain. After 3 years he weds Idril, Tuor and Beren alone of all mortals ever wedded elves, and since Elwing, daughter of Dior, Beren's son, wedded Eärendil, son of Tuor and Idril, of them alone has come the strain of elfiness into mortal blood. Not long after this, Meglin, going far afield over the mountains, is taken by orcs, and purchases his life when taken to Angband, by revealing Gondolin and its secrets. Morgoth promises him the lordship of Gondolin and possession of Idril. Lust for Idril led him the easier to his treachery and added to his hatred for Tuor. Morgoth sends him back to Gondolin. Eärendil is born, having the beauty and light and wisdom of elfiness, the hardihood and strength of men, and the longing for the sea which captured Tuor and held him forever when Ilmir spoke to him in the Land of Willows. At last Morgoth is ready, and the attack is made on Gondolin with dragons, Balrogs, and orcs. After a dreadful fight about the walls, the city is stormed, and Turgon perishes with many of the most noble in the last fight in the Great Square. Tuor rescues Idril and Eärendil from Meglin and hurls him from the battlements. He then leads the remnant of the people of Gondolin down a secret tunnel previously made by Idril's advice, which comes out far in the north of the plain. Those who would not come with him but fled to the old way of escape are caught by the dragon sent by Morgoth to watch that exit. In the fume of the burning, Tuor leads his company into the mountains, into the cold pass of Christhorn, Eagle's Cleft. There they are ambushed, but saved by the valour of Glorfindel, chief of the House of the Golden Flower of Gondolin, who dies in a duel with a Balrog upon a pinnacle, and the intervention of Thorondor. The remnant reaches Sirion, and journeys to the land at its mouth, the waters of Sirion. Morgoth's triumph is now complete.
The story told in this compressed form had not greatly changed from its form in the tale of the fall of Gondolin, but there are nonetheless significant developments. It is here that Tuor of the tale is placed within the genealogy of the Edain, the elf friends. He has become the son of Huor, the brother of Hurin, who was the father of the tragic hero Turin Turambar. Thus, Tuor was first cousin of Turin. Here, too, emerges the story that Huor was slain in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, and that his wife Rian searched for his body on the battlefield and died there. Tuor, their son, remained in Hithlum and was enslaved by the faithless men whom Morgoth drove into Hithlum after that battle. But he escaped from them and took to a solitary life in the wilds. A major difference in the early versions of the story, in respect of the wider history of the Elder Days, lies in what my father told of the discovery of the Vale of Tumladen, hidden in the encircling mountains. In the sketch of the mythology, it is said that the people of Turgon, escaping from the great battle near Nyaeth Arnoediad, Unnumbered Tears, disappeared from the knowledge of Morgoth, because in a secret place in the hills, their scouts climbing to the tops discovered a broad valley entirely encircled by the hills. But in the days of the writing of the tale of the fall of Gondolin, the story had been that there was a long age after the terrible battle before the destruction of Gondolin. It was said that Tuor heard, when he came there, how unstaying labour through ages of years had not sufficed to its building and adornment, whereat folk travailed yet. The chronological difficulties led my father later to place the discovery of the site of Gondolin by Turgon and its building to a time many centuries before the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Turgon led his people, fleeing south, down Sirion, from the battlefield to the hidden city that he had founded a great age before. It was to a very ancient city that Tuor came. A distinctive change in the story of the attack on Gondolin occurs, as I believe, in the sketch of the mythology. In the tale of the fall of Gondolin, it was told that Morgoth had discovered Gondolin before Meglin was captured by orcs. He became very suspicious at the strange news that a man had been seen wandering amid the dales of the waters of Sirion, and to this end he gathered a mighty army of spies, of animals and birds and reptiles, who, through the years untiring, brought back to him a mass of information. From the encircling mountains, his spies had looked down on the plain of Tumladen. Even the way of escape had been revealed. When Eärendil was a year old, tidings were brought to Gondolin of how the agents of Morgoth had encompassed the Vale of Tumladen all around, and Turgon strengthened the defences of the city. In the tale of the fall of Gondolin, the subsequent treachery of Meglin lay in his describing in detail the plan of Gondolin and all the preparations for its defence. With Melko, he devised a plan for the overthrow of Gondolin. But in the condensed account in the sketch, it is said that when Meglin was captured by orcs in the mountains, he purchased his life when taken to Angband by revealing Gondolin and its secrets. The words "revealing Gondolin" seem to me to show clearly that the change had entered and the later story was present. Morgoth did not know and could not discover where the hidden kingdom lay until the capture of Meglin by the orcs. But there was yet another change to follow. Refer to the additional notes section on Hurin and Gondolin. The story told in the Quenta Noldorinwa. I come now to a major Silmarillion text from which I took passages in Beren and Luthien, and I repeat here a part of the explanatory note from that book. After the sketch of the mythology, this text, which I will refer to as the Quenta, was the only complete and finished version of the Silmarillion that my father achieved, a typescript that he made in, as seems certain, 1930. No preliminary drafts or outlines, if there were any, survive. but it is plain that for a good part of its length he had the sketch before him. It is longer than the sketch, and the Silmarillion style has clearly appeared, but it remains a compression, a compendious account. In calling this text a compression, I do not mean to suggest that it was a hasty piece of work, awaiting a more finished treatment at some later time. Comparison of the two versions, Q1 and Q2, as will be explained later, shows how attentively he heard and weighed the rhythm of the phrases. But compression there was, indeed. Witness the 20 or so lines devoted to the battle in the Quenta, compared with the 12 pages in the tale. Towards the end of the Quenta, my father expanded and retyped portions of the text while preserving the discarded pages. The text as it stood before this rewriting I will call Q1. Near the end of the narrative, Q1 gives out, and only the rewritten version, Q2, continues to the end. It seems clear from this that the rewriting, which concerns Gondolin and its destruction, belongs to the same time, and I have given the Q2 text throughout, from the point where the tale of Gondolin begins. The name of the King of Eagles, Thorndor, was changed throughout the text to Thorondor. It will be seen that in the Quenta manuscript as written, the story told in the sketch was still present. The Vale of Gondolin was discovered by scouts of Turgon's people fleeing from the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. At some later but unidentifiable time, my father rewrote all the relevant passages, and these revisions are included in the text that follows here.
Here must be told of Gondolin. The great river Sirion, mightiest in Elvish song, flowed through all the land of Beleriand, and its course was southwest. And at its mouth was a great delta, and its lower course ran through green and fertile lands, little peopled save by birds and beasts. Yet the orcs came seldom there, for it was far from the northern woods and fells, and the power of Ulmo waxed ever in that water as it drew nigh to the sea. For the mouths of that river were in the western sea, whose uttermost borders are the shores of Valinor. Turgon, Fingolfin's son, had a sister Isfin, the white-handed. She was lost in Tawanafuin after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. There she was captured by the dark elf Eol, and it is said that he was of gloomy mood, and had deserted the hosts ere the battle, yet he had not fought on Morgoth's side. But Isfin he took to wife, and their son was Meglin. Now the people of Turgon, escaping from the battle, aided by the prowess of Húrin, as has been told, escaped from the knowledge of Morgoth and vanished from all men's eyes, and Ulmo alone knew whither they had gone.
Initially, the text stated, their scouts climbing the heights had come upon a secret place in the mountains, a broad valley. This was then changed to,
for they returned to the hidden city of Gondolin that Turgon had built. In a secret place in the mountains there was a broad valley entirely circled by the hills, ringed about in a fence unbroken, but falling ever lower as they came towards the middle. In the midmost of this marvellous ring was a wide land and a green plain, wherein was no hill, save for a single rocky height. This stood up dark upon the plain, not right at its centre, but nearest to that part of the outer wall that marched close to the borders of Sirion. Highest were the encircling mountains towards the north, and the threat of Angband, and on their outer slopes to east and north began the shadow of dread Tawanafuin, but they were crowned with the cairn of Fingolfin, and no evil came that way, as yet. In this valley,
the gnomes took refuge, later changed to,
Turgon had taken refuge, and spells of hiding and enchantment were set on all the hills about, that foes and spies might never find it. In this Turgon had the aid of the messages of Ulmo, that came now up the river Sirion, for his voice is to be heard in many waters, and some of the gnomes had yet the lore to hearken. In those days Ulmo was filled with pity for the exiled elves in their need, and in the ruin that had now almost overwhelmed them. He foretold that the fortress of Gondolin should stand longest of all the refuges of the elves against the might of Morgoth, and like Doriath, never be overthrown, save by treachery from within. Because of his protecting might, the spells of concealment were strongest in those parts nearest to Sirion, though there the encircling mountains were at their lowest. In that region the gnomes dug a great winding tunnel under the roots of the hills, and its issue was in the steep side, tree-clad and dark, of a gorge through which the blissful river ran. There he was still a young stream, but strong, flowing down the narrow vale that lies between the shoulders of the encircling mountains and the mountains of shadow, Erid Lomin.
Later changed to Erid Wethion.
The walls of Hithlum.
This replaced in whose northern heights he took his rise.
That passage they made at first to be a way of return for fugitives and for such as escaped from the bondage of Morgoth, and most as an issue for their scouts and messengers. For Turgon deemed, when first they came into that vale after the dreadful battle,
this sentence marked with an X for rejection, but without replacement,
that Morgoth Bauglir had grown too mighty for elves and men, and that it were better to seek the forgiveness and aid of the Valar, if either might be got, ere all was lost. Wherefore some of his folk went down the river Sirion at whiles, ere the shadow of Morgoth yet stretched into the uttermost parts of Beleriand, and a small and secret haven they made at his mouth. Thence ever and anon ships would set forth into the west, bearing the embassy of the gnomish king. Some there were that came back driven by contrary winds, but the most never returned again, and none reached Valinor. The issue of that way of escape was guarded and concealed by the mightiest spells they could contrive, and by the power that dwelt in Sirion, beloved of Ulmo, and no thing of evil found it. Yet its inner gate, which looked upon the Vale of Gondolin, was watched unceasingly by the gnomes. In those days Thorondor, king of eagles, removed his eyries from Thangorodrim, because of the power of Morgoth, and the stench and fumes, and the evil of the dark clouds that lay now ever upon the mountain towers above his cavernous halls. But Thorondor dwelt upon the northward heights of the encircling mountains, and he kept watch and saw many things, sitting upon the cairn of King Fingolfin. And in the vale below dwelt Turgon, Fingolfin's son. Upon Amon Gwarith, the hill of defence, the rocky height amidst the plain, was built Gondolin the Great, whose fame and glory is mightiest in song of all dwellings of the elves in these outer lands. Of steel were its gates, and of marble were its walls. The sides of the hill the gnomes polished to the smoothness of dark glass, and its top they levelled for the building of their town, save amidmost, where stood the tower and palace of the king. Many fountains there were in that city, and white waters fell shimmering down the glistening sides of Amon Gwarith. The plain all about they smoothed till it became as a lawn of shaven grass from the stairways before the gates unto the feet of the mountain wall, and naught might walk or creep across unseen. In that city the folk waxed mighty, and their armouries were filled with weapons and with shields, for they purposed at first to come forth to war when the hour was ripe. But as the years drew on, they grew to love that place, the work of their hands, as the gnomes do, with a great love, and desired no better. Then seldom went any forth from Gondolin on errand of war or peace again. They sent no messengers more into the west, and Sirion's haven was desolate. They shut them behind their impenetrable and enchanted hills, and suffered none to enter, though he fled from Morgoth hate-pursued. Tidings of the lands without came to them faint and far, and they heeded them little, and their dwelling became as a rumour, and a secret no man could find. They succoured not Nargothrond nor Doriath, and the wandering elves sought them in vain, and Ulmo alone knew where the realm of Turgon could be found. Tidings Turgon heard of Thorondor concerning the slaying of Deor, Thingol's heir, and thereafter he shut his ear to word of the woes without, and he vowed to march never at the side of any son of Feanor, and his folk he forbade ever to pass the leaguer of the hills. Gondolin now alone remained of all the strongholds of the elves. Morgoth forgot not Turgon, and knew that without knowledge of that king his triumph could not be achieved. Yet his search unceasing was in vain. Nargothrond was void, Doriath desolate. The sons of Feanor driven away to a wild woodland life in the south and east. Hithlum was filled with evil men, and Tower na Fuin was a place of nameless dread. The race of Hador was at an end, and the house of Finrod. Beren came no more to war, and Huan was slain, and all elves and men bowed to his will, or laboured as slaves in the mines and smithies of Angband, save only the wild and wandering, and few there were of these, save far in the east of once fair Beleriand. His triumph was near complete, and yet was not quite full. On a time Eol was lost in Tower na Fuin, and Isfin came through great peril and dread unto Gondolin, and after her coming none entered until the last messenger of Ulmo, of whom the tales speak more ere the end. With her came her son Meglin, and he was there received by Turgon as his sister son, and though he was half of dark elven blood, he was treated as a prince of Fingolfin's line. He was swart but comely, wise and eloquent, and cunning to win men's hearts and minds. Now Húrin of Hithlum had a brother Huor. The son of Huor was Tuor. Rian, Huor's wife, sought her husband among the slain upon the field of unnumbered tears, and there bewailed him ere she died. Her son was but a child, and remaining in Hithlum fell into the hands of the faithless men whom Morgoth drove into that land after the battle, and he became a thrall. Growing of age, and he was fair of face and great of stature, and despite his grievous life, valiant and wise, he escaped into the woods, and he became an outlaw and a solitary, living alone and communing with none save rarely wandering and hidden elves.
The text here is somewhat confused by hasty changes. In this rewriting, it is told that Rian went forth into the wild, where Tuor was born, and that he was fostered by the dark elves, but Rian laid herself down and died upon the hill of Slain. But Tuor grew up in the woods of Hithlum, and he was fair of face and great of stature. There is thus in the rewriting no mention of an enslavement of Tuor.
On a time Ulmo contrived, as is told in the tale of the fall of Gondolin, that he should be led to a river course that flowed underground from Lake Mithrim in the midst of Hithlum into a great chasm, Chris Ilfing,
later changed to Kirith Helvin,
the Rainbow Cleft, through which a turbulent water ran at last into the Western Sea. And the name of this chasm was so devised by reason of the rainbow that shimmered ever in the sun in that place, because of the abundance of the spray of the rapids and the waterfalls. In this way the flight of Tuor was marked by no man nor elf, neither was it known to the orcs or any spy of Morgoth, with whom the land of Hithlum was filled. Tuor wandered long by the western shores, journeying ever south, and he came at last to the mouths of Sirion, and the sandy deltas peopled by many birds of the sea. There he fell in with a gnome, Bronwy, who had escaped from Angband, and being of old of the people of Turgon, sought ever to find the path to the hidden places of his lord, of which rumour ran among all captives and fugitives. Now Bronwy had come thither by far and wandering paths to the east, and little though any step back nigher to the thraldom from which he had come was to his liking, he purposed now to go up Sirion, and seek for Turgon in Beleriand. Fearful and very wary was he, and he aided Tuor in their secret march by night and twilight, so that they were not discovered by the orcs. They came first into the fair land of willows, Nan Tathrim, which is watered by the Narog and by Sirion, and there all things were yet green, and the meads were rich and full of flowers, and there was song of many birds, so that Tuor lingered there as one enchanted, and it seemed sweet to him to dwell there after the grim lands of the north and his weary wandering. There Ulmo came and appeared before him, as he stood in the long grass at evening, and the might and majesty of that vision is told of in the song of Tuor that he made for his son Eärendil. Thereafter the sound of the sea and the longing for the sea was ever in Tuor's heart and ear, and an unquiet was on him at whiles, that took him at last into the depths of the realm of Ulmo. But now Ulmo bade him make all speed to Gondolin, and gave him guidance for the finding of the hidden door, and a message he gave him to bear from Ulmo, friend of elves, unto Turgon, bidding him to prepare for war, and battle with Morgoth ere all was lost, and to send again his messengers into the west. Summons, too, should he send into the east, and gather, if he might, men, who were now multiplying and spreading on the earth, unto his banners. And for that task Tuor was most fit. "Forget," counselled Ulmo, "the treachery of Uldor the Accursed, and remember Húrin, for without mortal men the elves shall not prevail against the Balrogs and the orcs. Nor should the feud with the sons of Feanor be left unhealed, for this should be the last gathering of the hope of the gnomes, when every sword should count. A terrible and mortal strife," he foretold, "but victory, if Turgon would dare it, the breaking of Morgoth's power, and the healing of feuds, and friendship between men and elves, whereof the greatest good should come into the world, and the servants of Morgoth trouble it no more. But if Turgon would not go forth to this war, then he should abandon Gondolin and lead his people down Sirion, and build there his fleets and seek back to Valinor and the mercy of the gods." But in this council there was danger more dire than in the other, though so it might not seem, and grievous thereafter would be the fate of the hither lands. This errand Ulmo performed out of his love of the elves, and because he knew that ere many years were past, the doom of Gondolin would come, if its people sat still behind its walls. Not thus should anything of joy or beauty in the world be preserved from Morgoth's malice. Obedient to Ulmo, Tuor and Bronwe journeyed north, and came at last to the hidden door, and passing down the tunnel reached the inner gate, and were taken by the guard as prisoners. There they saw the fair vale of Tumladen set like a green jewel amid the hills, and amidst Tumladen Gondolin the Great, the city of seven names, white, shining from afar, flushed with the rose of dawn upon the plain. Thither they were led, and passed the gates of steel, and were brought before the steps of the palace of the king. There Tuor spoke the embassy of Ulmo, and something of the power and majesty of the Lord of Waters his voice had caught, so that all folk looked in wonder on him, and doubted that this were a man of mortal race, as he declared. But proud was Turgon become, and Gondolin as beautiful as a memory of Tún, and he trusted in its secret and impregnable strength, so that he and the most part of his folk wished not to imperil it nor leave it, and they desired not to mingle in the woes of elves and men without, nor did they any longer desire to return through dread and danger to the west. Meglin spoke ever against Tuor in the councils of the king, and his words seemed the more weighty in that they went with Turgon's heart. Wherefore Turgon rejected the bidding of Ulmo, though some there were of his wisest counsellors who were filled with disquiet. wise-hearted even beyond the measure of the daughters of Elphiness, was the daughter of the king, and she spoke ever for Tuor, though it did not avail, and her heart was heavy. Very fair and tall was she, well nigh of warrior's stature, and her hair was a fountain of gold. Idril was she named, and called Celebrindal, Silverfoot, for the whiteness of her foot. And she walked and danced ever unshod in the white ways and green lawns of Gondolin. Thereafter Tuor sojourned in Gondolin, and went not to summon the men of the east, for the blissfulness of Gondolin, the beauty and wisdom of its folk, held him enthralled. And he grew high in the favour of Turgon, for he became a mighty man in stature and in mind, learning deeply of the lore of the gnomes. The heart of Idril was turned to him, and his to her, at which Meglin ground his teeth, for he desired Idril, and despite his close kinship, purposed to possess her, and she was the only heir of the king of Gondolin. Indeed, in his heart he was already planning how he might oust Turgon and seize his throne, but Turgon loved and trusted him. Nonetheless, Tuor took Idril to wife, and the folk of Gondolin made merry feast, for Tuor had won their hearts, all save Meglin and his secret following. Tuor and Beren alone of mortal men had elves to wife, and since Elwing, daughter of Deor, son of Beren, after wedded Eorendil, son of Tuor and Idril of Gondolin, of them alone has come the elven blood into mortal race. But as yet Eorendil was a little child. Surpassing fair was he. A light was in his face as the light of heaven, and he had the beauty and the wisdom of Elphiness, and the strength and hardihood of the men of old, and the sea spoke ever in his ear and heart, even as with Tuor his father. On a time when Eorendil was yet young, and the days of Gondolin were full of joy and peace, and yet Idril's heart misgave her, and foreboding crept upon her spirit like a cloud, Meglin was lost. Now Meglin loved mining and quarrying after metals above other craft, and he was master and leader of the gnomes who worked in the mountains distant from the city, seeking for metals for their smithying of things both of peace and war. But often Meglin went with few of his folk beyond the leaguer of the hills, though the king knew not that his bidding was defied. And so it came to pass, as fate willed, that Meglin was taken prisoner by the orcs, and taken before Morgoth. Meglin was no weakling or craven, but the torment wherewith he was threatened cowed his soul, and he purchased his life and freedom by revealing unto Morgoth the place of Gondolin, and the ways whereby it might be found and assailed. Great indeed was the joy of Morgoth, and to Meglin he promised the lordship of Gondolin as his vassal, and the possession of Idril when that city should be taken. Lust for Idril and hatred of Tuor led Meglin the easier to his foul treachery. But Morgoth sent him back to Gondolin, lest men should suspect the betrayal, and so that Meglin should aid the assault from within when the hour came. And Meglin abode in the halls of the king with a smile on his face and evil in his heart, while the gloom gathered ever deeper upon Idril. At last, and Eorendil was then 7 years of age, Morgoth was ready. And he loosed upon Gondolin his orcs and his Balrogs and his serpents. And of these, dragons of many and dire shapes were new devised for the taking of the city. The host of Morgoth came over the northern hills where the height was greatest and the watch less vigilant, and it came at night at a time of festival, when all the folk of Gondolin were upon the walls to wait upon the rising sun and sing their songs at its uplifting, for the morrow was the feast which they named the Gates of Summer. But the red light mounted the hills in the north and not in the east, and there was no stay in the advance of the foe until they were beneath the very walls of Gondolin, and Gondolin was beleaguered without hope. Of the deeds of desperate valour there done, by the chieftains of the noble houses and their warriors, and not least by Tuor, is much told in the fall of Gondolin. Of the death of Rog without the walls, and of the battle of Ecthelion of the Fountain with Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, in the very square of the king, where each slew the other, and of the defence of the Tower of Turgon by the men of his household, until the tower was overthrown, and mighty was its fall and the fall of Turgon in its ruin. Tuor sought to rescue Idril from the sack of the city, but Meglin had laid hands upon her and Eärendil, and Tuor fought on the walls with him and cast him down to death. Then Tuor and Idril led such remnants of the folk of Gondolin as they could gather in the confusion of the burning, down a secret way that Idril had let prepare in the days of her foreboding. This was not yet complete, but its issue was already far beyond the walls, and in the north of the plain, where the mountains were long distant from Amon Gwareth. Those who would not come with them, but fled to the old way of escape that led into the gorge of Sirion, were caught and destroyed by a dragon that Morgoth had sent to watch that gate, being apprised of it by Meglin. But of the new passage Meglin had not heard, and it was not thought that fugitives would take a path towards the north, and the highest parts of the mountain, and the nighest to Angband. The fume of the burning, and the steam of the fair fountains of Gondolin withering in the flame of the dragons of the north, fell upon the vale in mournful mists. And thus was the escape of Tuor and his company aided, for there was still a long and open road to follow from the tunnel's mouth to the foothills of the mountains. They came nonetheless into the mountains in woe and misery, for the high places were cold and terrible, and they had among them many women and children, and many wounded men. There is a dreadful pass, Christhorn,
later changed to Kirith Thoranath,
was it named, the Eagle's Cleft, where beneath the shadow of the highest peaks a narrow path winds its way, walled by a precipice to the right, and on the left a dreadful fall leaps into emptiness. Along that narrow way their march was strung when it was ambushed by an outpost of Morgoth's power, and a Balrog was their leader.